Dublin's Talking Sport with Ken Doherty and Reggie Corrigan.
Sponsored by InsureMyVan.ie. Reduce your price, not your cover.
Ladies and gentlemen, at the start of the fourth round, Gordon Blair having retired, the winner, Michael Carew.
By Kinsler, Quinn heads on. Oh, surely this time for Keane. And Ireland do it. Robbie Keane.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
A very good morning to you. I'm Reggie Corrigan and welcome to Dublin's Talking Sport with thanks to InsureMyVan.ie. Coming up on this morning's show, we'll be talking to our own Ken very shortly about the snooker and everything else that's been happening in sport this week. Brian O'Rourke of Cricket Leinster, he's the development manager there, will be discussing how cricket have dealt with COVID-19 and the comeback and the good news this week that we are getting back to some level of semi-normality when it comes to sport outside. We'll have the racing coming through as well from Andrew Blair White, racing pundit with the Racing Post as well. He'll be giving his Lucky 15 and preview on all of the racing for this weekend. I'm delighted to have Shane Byrne on as well just after 10 o'clock to discuss Leinster's chances and what people are calling Ronan O'Gara's La Rochelle. It's great. Rog got a team for himself in all this training he's been doing and coaching he's been doing around the world, but it will be a cracker, so Shane is going to catch up on that with me. Then we're going to be talking to a new contributor this week. I'm really looking forward to talking to Deirdre Smith, who's one of Ireland's leading golf amateurs, about all of the golf in general, and in particular we're going to have a little look at the women's performances in the recent LPGA events. Alan Cawley, of course, of Cawley's Call, will be with us to go through all of the League of Ireland and Premier League and Champions League and Europa League all of this week. So as always, you can get in touch with us on the show by texting us on 087 11 55 777 or WhatsApp on 087 188 1068. We're on Instagram, Facebook and Twitter as well. Now, as I said, it's time to turn our attention to the headlines. Delighted to be joined by Ken. Morning, Ken.
Morning, Reg. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Yeah, it's a cracking morning here in Dublin. I presume it's the same over there, although it's supposed to be a little bit stormy and wet and messy this weekend over here for the bank holiday, but we'll manage. But I'm good. I'm in good form. How's everything over there?
Yeah, very good. Beautiful morning here in Sheffield, getting ready for the semi-finals, of course, this week, this weekend, and then, of course, the final tomorrow and Monday. So last day of the semi-finals today between Corey Mills and Sean Murphy. And a bit of a grueler last night. I was in the studio last night for the Selby Bingham. Well, 13-11 to Bingham. He was 9-7 down in that semi. He's turned it around. 4.5 hours they took for 8 frames. An absolute grueler.
That's unbelievable. I've been watching myself. I mean, Bingham, he seems to have found a vein of form, we thought, at just the right time. But Selby is so good. Like, I mean, it's been tit for tat now. I know they've been taking. It's been a slow game. There's no question about it. It's been pretty slow to watch. But I don't know. There's something about Bingham at the moment. He seems to have a little bit of a pep in his step.
He does, yeah. And he's really sort of getting the crowd going as well. I don't know. You know, last night he came back out after. There was a one frame, Reg. Went on for 60 minutes, honestly. It was. And it finished on a black ball. And it was so dramatic. Bingham fluked the blue and snookered himself on the pink. He got out of the snooker. Then he fluked the pink and he eventually potted the black and went out. When he came back into the arena, Selby was still out and he came back in and he was sort of giving it as if to the crowd, come on, let's go. Let's have you as a bit more noisy, you know. And the crowd really sort of got on his side. And it was quite incredible turnaround. From 9-7 down, he won 6-2. And he's 13-11. He needs four more to go into his only his second final. He won it in, 2015. Yeah. And he's not been to the semi-final or the final since. So this is an incredible journey for him. And, of course, he came through two qualifying matches as well.
Yeah, and there was one part in it where you're talking about it taking a while. Like, Selby came along and he was going around looking at the table. Oh. Looking left, looking right. And in the end, the referee, Ben Williams, stepped in and he said, well, come on, get on with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And he was dead right. And it's not often you see a referee do that. I mean, there was one time during last season where Selby took over 6 minutes on one shot and the referee never said anything to him. So I was delighted that Ben Williams took the initiative and said to him, like, come on, let's hurry up, because it was a few shots he was taking over a minute, minute and a half, and it was just too long. He was trying to slow, like, bring him down, knock him out of his stride. I mean, he's such a great player, but he doesn't need to do that. I mean, he played on the very last frame. He needed five snookers, and he was still playing. I mean, even the crowd wanted to go home and go to bed. It was well after 11. They'd been in there for 4.5 hours. And, yeah, he's just, you have to scrape him off the table, Selby. But he's under big trouble. He's under big pressure now. 13-11 down. He was 9-7 up. He thought, like, he was going to coast to the line, but no way. Stuart Bingham has had other things in mind. He played fantastic, Stuart Bingham.
Is that just, like, is that mind games completely trying to knock
Bingham off his game? Big time. And also, maybe it's just a default mode that Selby goes into when he's behind, and particularly in the World Championships, that, you know, he just tries to break things down and slow the pace down and get back into sort of his rhythm and knock the other guy out of his rhythm. Because Bingham was absolutely flying. I mean, he won like five frames in a row, and, you know, everything was going swimmingly well for him, and then it just got bogged down. But, yeah, it'd be interesting. They start back out this afternoon, and Wilson and Murphy, they're on. They start off at 10 o'clock this morning.
I see Jimmy White has come out and said that Karen Wilson is going to be the new world champion. You know, there's obviously a bit of interest here with Sean Murphy living in Dublin now, but yeah. It does seem like Wilson is in the form at the moment.
Yeah, he is. He's in great form. You know, we lost in the final here last year to Ronnie O'Sullivan heavily. But it's sort of... in a one way, and you know what, the way sport, even your sort of bad experience can be good for you, because you can come back stronger from them and you can learn from them a lot more. And I think that's exactly what's happened to Corin Wilson. He was devastated last year, of course, losing to Ronnie O'Sullivan. But it's made him a lot stronger. This season, he's been very, very consistent, knocking on the door of lots of the big tournaments. He's only won one ranking tournament, but... he's been at the business end of most of the others, and now he's back in the semi-final. He's in a really strong position, and he's 10-6 up.
Yeah. And as you're looking at it, and you know, you get a feel for it when you're at events like this and you feel how it's going, do you see it being a Wilson-Bingham final? Is that, I know, the way it's...
I would say so. I mean, Wilson was 10-4 up at one stage yesterday, and Murphy somehow managed to win the last two. I mean, he hasn't played as well, Murphy, as he did against Trump in the quarterfinal. I mean, he totally outplayed Judd Trump, potted some unbelievable balls, made some brilliant breaks. He stomps around the table. He plays very fast, very fluid. And but Wilson's totally dominated yesterday's session. But Murphy won the last two and got out of sort of jail. So they finished the session 4-all. But it was a huge last couple of frames for Murphy. And if he can get off to a good start, he might be able to get into a rhythm. You know, and that's what he's hoping for. He just hasn't really sort of started the way he sort of finished off against Trump. So, but he needs the first couple of frames, I think, this morning to really get him going and get sort of Wilson. He fist pumped, you know, up to the crowd, up to Wilson's like balcony, because they must have been shouting and roaring for Wilson all the time, and it might have been annoying him. So he fist pumped up to his own balcony where his family were, and then he sort of fist pumped up to the other balcony as if to say, there you go, up yours. I won a good frame. I'm still in this match, you know. It was quite nice.
Yeah, there's no doubt he's not going to give up easy, no question about that.
You don't see that among snooker players, like, you know, like you do with other sports. You like to see it a little bit more, like, you know, in a way.
Yeah, no. You see, I suppose over the years it's always been the kind of the perfect turnout.
The gentlemanly
thing. You don't do this, you don't do that, and everything else. You're not. You're getting the crowd riled up and getting.
No.
Alex did not by doing that, but just by the way he played back in the day, Alex.
Yeah.
He used to get the crowd. I remember back in those days watching.
Oh yeah.
And screaming and everything.
Yeah.
There might have been a bit more drink allowed into the arena back then.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, he used to. I mean, that was a famous funny story. You know, like when he asked me about when I used to get him drinks down in Gops. You know, and he said to me, he says, you know, if I ask you for an orange juice, that means a vodka and orange juice. You know, and if I ask you for a vodka and orange juice, that means a double. Yeah. And I said, is that when you're playing, Mr. Higgins? Yes, babe, of course. What else do you think? The referee used to come into the dressing rooms, you know, and ask when you were allowed to have a drink.
Yeah.
And he'd have his little notebook and he'd say, you know, okay, what do you want? Just water or whatever it might be, you know. And then one of the older players says, Rex, what do you want? He says, I'll have a large whiskey. And if I lose the first frame, I'll have another one.
Setting the nerves. Like, I don't know who was talking about, Bill Werbenig.
Werbenig, oh yeah. Werbenig.
You were saying, I think it was you that were saying in one of your stories during the week that he'd gotten through 24 cans or something before an exhibition match.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. I was playing in a tournament. It was a pro-am. I was still an amateur.
Yeah.
And it was down to the last 16 on the Sunday. We were there on the Saturday, and we came back for the 10 o'clock session on the Sunday morning. Bill Werbenig was finishing off the pro-am by playing an exhibition. Now, he wasn't due to play till 7 o'clock that night.
Huh.
And we were in the club from 9 o'clock practicing and having something to eat before the 10 o'clock session. And Bill Werbenig was sat at the bar with 24 cans in front of him. And he was getting ready for the 7 o'clock that night. You know, he had to consume that amount of alcohol, you know. It was funny. When he was doing it at the Crucible, you know, he used to have a pint every frame. And, of course, it's 19 frames it could go to.
Yeah.
And he bent over the table one time, and you know, of course, with all that gas, you know.
I can imagine.
Yeah. So anyway, he let rip as he bent over the table, and he got back off the table. The whole crowd were starting to laugh, like, and they were looking around. And he got back up off the table, and he looked to somebody in the front row, and he said, "Was that you?"
Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
Okay, what about United during the week? 6-2, hell of a performance.
Yeah, it was great, wasn't it? I mean, it started off a bit dodgy, but it was. Do you remember when they played Roma in the Champions League? They beat them 7-1. It was quite similar in lots of ways.
Mm.
And I thought the second half performance was magnificent. I know Roma sort of collapsed a little bit, but. Great to see, you know, great to see the goals coming. Fernandes played great, Pogba, and particularly Cavani. Cavani has made such a difference to the team. His movement, you know, even his passing for that goal for Rashford, for Greenwood when he came on, you know, with the outside of the foot across the park. Yeah, it's just been magnificent. It's great to see them on a little bit of a roll, and hopefully, I mean, that'll put them in the final, but hopefully that they can get a trophy this season. I think Ollie deserves it. You know, he's lost in so many semi-finals. He's getting a little bit of stick for that. But it would be great. I know it's only the Europa League, but listen.
I'd take anything.
Small. Yeah, yeah. I'd be thankful for small mercies, as they say. And it'd be great to win a cup. But, you know, and I'd love to see Arsenal in the other.
It would be fantastic.
Yeah. It could be Chelsea, Man City in the European Champions League final. It could be Arsenal against Manchester United in the Europa League final. That would be something else.
Yeah, City again. Special, you know.
Very, very good. I mean, they're so good. The manager is so good. And the players that they have are just fantastic. You know, they're top quality.
A big performance. Like getting a win against PSG away from home. I know there's a red card involved and all that, but it's a huge result. It really is.
I mean, they could do they can't do the quadruple now, but
no.
They can certainly do the treble, yeah. You know. So, it'd be very, very interesting. But, you know, I like Pep Guardiola. I think he's a great manager. He's brought an awful lot to the Premiership. And of course, the way they play, you know, he's got a huge influence on a lot of teams. I mean, he was one of the first, wasn't he, to play out from the back, and now all the teams seem to be doing it. And it's just the style of football, the pressing, the high pressing, everything. It's just fantastic. Great to watch.
It is, no question about it. He has the players to do it, you can argue that, but I mean, it is.
Yeah.
He's an ambition to play, you know, he wants to play a certain style, and it's working well. They're coming to get you there in the background, are they?
No, I know.
What about the big one tomorrow? Liverpool, United, Liverpool, obviously, huge game.
Yeah.
I suppose the people, Liverpool are the ones that are under the massive pressure coming into this one because the season has completely fallen apart for them and they need to get, like, against one of their biggest rivals, they just need to try and get a result, but it's looking very dodgy for Klopp. to get that result.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I mean they've had a terrible season, you know, particularly stemmed from the injuries, and just it went from there. The sort of confidence had drained out of the side, and you know it can happen. It's just been unfortunate, you know, very unfortunate. But they're still a great team. It's got great individual players. And, you know, this is the fixture that Man United fans, and I'm sure Liverpool fans are the same, when they look at the fixtures every year, they want to know when they play United at home and away. And it's the same for us. I mean, it's the biggest rivalry in even bigger than playing Man City, of course, the team from their own city. But, you know, the Liverpool, this is the match that sort of I grew up watching, you know. I mean, when I saw Manchester United play Liverpool in the FA Cup final in 1977, that was when I started following Manchester United. And, you know, these are the great games. And I'm sure it'll be no different. It's a shame, obviously. It'd be great if there was crowds. But it's still a great game. And looking forward to it. And, of course, you know, it's a big game for both teams, but particularly for Liverpool to try and get into that Champions League, because it's looking very, very dodgy at the moment. They need the 3 points now, I think, more than United do.
And there's all sorts of stuff going on around it as well. I see there's a big protest being planned. 10,000 fans are talking about trying to block both buses from getting into Old Trafford tomorrow for that game in protest against the Glazers and the owners and the mess that they made around this whole Super League. So it's... it's kind of... it's going to it'll add a little bit of spice to the whole thing.
Oh, yeah. As long as, you know, everybody's safe and stuff like that. Yeah, but I understand... I can understand the supporters. I don't think that will do any good by stopping the buses going into, but certainly to voice their, you know, their opinions about the whole Super League stuff and how sort of the greed of the owners, of all the owners, and not just Manchester United, the Glazers, but of Liverpool and Arsenal and all the teams that were involved from the Premiership. It was just great. But the great thing was that the supporters spoke and they got together and they brought it down. And that's for the good of football.
No question about it. Listen, what do you make of this social media ban thing that's going on this weekend across sport? You know, there's pressure on... I don't know what to make a lot of these campaigns that they do. You know, you have all of the different movements that there's been, and there's no garner support by having all the social media platforms. But then you have all of the social media platforms, and there's no accountability, and there's fake accounts, and there's everything else.
Is this
another one of those? I don't want to say token, but like, I mean, I just don't really get what can be benefited out of this ban. It seems to be that everybody's almost been forced into doing it.
Exactly. You're damned if you do, and damned if you don't.
Yeah,
I totally agree. I mean, they've asked Snooker to ban it. Barry Hearnack, chairman, said absolutely not on the biggest weekend of our sport. You know, with the World Championships and for our sponsors and stuff like that. It was really bad timing for Snooker. If it had been the following weekend, it would have been no problem, but not on the sort of the final of our World Championship. So, I totally understand. I can understand the sort of the importance of it because of the online abuse, racial abuse, bullying, you know, people setting up fake accounts, and there's no accountability, as you said. That is totally wrong. Things like that have to change on social media. You should be, when you set up an account, you've got to give ID and stuff like that. You have to do it on other sort of apps.
Yeah.
So why not do it on Twitter, Instagram, you know, Facebook and etc., TikTok, whatever it may be. I think that's important. I think that's going forward, it is very, very important because there's so much abuse. I mean, you see some of the trolls that the footballers or people, and you even get it in snooker, Reg. You know, I mean, I get it sometimes. You know, like you might lose a match and then you'd have guys or people like coming on and saying, you know, all sorts of stuff because they might have had a bet on or, you know, like, and that's where it stems from. But the racial stuff is even worse, whatever about losing matches and being trolled by guys that have bets, but the racial and the bullying and stuff that goes way beyond, and that has to stop.
Yeah, I know,
but I don't know about this campaign. I'm not 100% about the campaign. I don't know what that can do.
Well, I'd be with you on that. I mean, my own feeling on it is, I feel there's an awful lot of tokenism these days, you know, that there's a case of like, oh, well, we need to be seen to do something that's going to make a big dramatic impact, and then we look like the good guys, blah, 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 blah. And that, this feels like one of those. In reality, if you look at what happened in Australia, for example, with Facebook, the Australian government banned Facebook. I mean, that seems unheard of. That seems like something that couldn't possibly happen. But it happened for about 3 weeks, where they banned Facebook because Facebook wouldn't pay content providers anything for it. And in the end, Facebook had to back down, and there was an agreement reached on it. So it seems like it's something that has to come in at government level more so than everything else, because, you know, these companies, they all talk about the users being, you know, all important. But at the end of the day, they don't produce anything, these companies. They're just providing a platform for people to voice an opinion. So the users are actually the commodity, and they're what make these companies worth so much. So I think it's the governments that need to put in place that if you want to operate in our jurisdiction, well, then you have to be accountable.
Absolutely, yeah. I totally agree. I think that would really, that would be a proper voice, you know, and that would, like those sort of rules, as you said, in Australia, that makes a lot of sense to me. I think that you're completely right, because it has to stop. You cannot get away with some of the stuff that people are saying on social media to other people. I mean, it's causing a lot of harm and causing deaths in some time, because people get so overcome with it that they take their own lives because of it, you know, and it's just not right. It's not right. People hiding behind these, like, keyboard warriors is the cause, you know. And they have to be made accountable.
You see, you know, that young lad in Kerry, and I feel for him. He's only a kid, and he made a mistake against Ian Wright, and it was something stupid. But, you know, it was held accountable, and people were giving out about Wright, and he shouldn't have brought it all the way, and blah, 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 ruining his life. But I suppose until people are made to realise there are consequences to your actions, they'll just continue to do it.
Of course they will, and they think it's funny in a way, you know, and they think their mates will get involved, and then their mates start doing it, you know, because they can't be held accountable, and it just snowballs. Yeah. Where is it going to end? Like, that is the thing. Where does this end? If you don't stop or nip it in the bud, where will it end, you know?
It's interesting, all right. Okay, prediction for the snooker before I let you go.
I'm hoping for a Morphy Bingham final.
Yeah.
That's what I'll be hoping. I'd love to see Sean Morphy lift it. He's a good lad. He loves living in Dublin. He loves living back there with his family and everything. He lives up in Rathfarnham, and he's a really good lad. I'd love to see him win it.
I was thinking, I actually thought about it during the week, if he did win it, he'd have to bring the trophy back here, and you could bring him on the roof for the open top bus. You remember the roof, man.
I'll be driving the bus.
I'll take the fares. I'll go down and be a conductor. You drive the bus, you know, I'll do the conductor.
I know. You know, when I was on that bus with the trophy, and I nearly let the trophy fall off the top of the bus, you know. I was looking around with me, and I nearly went off. Can you imagine if it went off and under the bus like it did? Remember Real Madrid did that?
Absolutely.
Let the trophy fall. That would be great. It would be fantastic to have him back as a world champion.
You didn't drop the trophy, but when I was captain, we won the Celtic League. I lost the trophy for about a week, so that's not too bad. We were in Kylie's drinking out of it, and some lad legged it with the trophy, and of course I got the blame for it, but I think there was about another 30 players in there too who didn't notice that.
Got out
the door. I think he woke up the next morning in bed with the trophy and kind of went, oh geez, what am I after doing? So it found its way back to Donnybrook Station eventually, but it was a nervous week, I can tell you. I got a lot of nervous phone calls from the Leinster manager at the time, wondering, had I seen or heard of the trophy? We got over it. Brilliant. Listen, I'll talk to you again next week. You mind yourself and enjoy the
snooker. Have a great weekend, Rich.
All the best. That's our own Ken Doherty there, giving us all the chat from England and talking about the snooker.
The comeback. COVID-19 and the return of sports on Dublin's Talking Sport from Sunshine 106.8.
There, of course, it is the COVID comeback. You're welcome back to Dublin's Talking Sport here on Sunshine 106.8 with thanks to InsureMyVan.ie. And it is the COVID comeback, and I'm delighted to be joined this week with the development manager from Cricket Leinster, who is Breon O'Rourke. Good morning, Breon. How are you?
Good morning, Reggie. All good there. Thank you.
Good to hear. I'm sure, like everybody else, you're excited and happy to hear about all the announcements during the week and a kind of gradual return to sport for all of us.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And we're in the same boat as all the other sports, really. But cricket, especially, we're a summer sport. We normally get up and running middle of April. So this is very timely for us. Lots of activities there during the week from last Monday to 26th. I was floating around the different clubs around Dublin. And the junior players, boys and girls, were getting lots of activities. We had great sessions last night in Balbriggan. There was other sessions in Railway Union and Sandymount, Leinster Cricket Union sessions, and then the girls were on today in Castlelaw College over in West Dublin. So lots of activities. Still a while to wait for matches, but it's not bad. All things considered, we're out and about and playing, and that's the main thing.
And tell me, Breen, from visiting all the clubs, as you have said there, what's the mood like in general? Obviously, people have found it difficult during COVID, but are they like are they able to cope financially and all those types of things? Have they managed to be okay?
Yeah, I think the people I spoke to there during the week were very upbeat. They just want to get back out playing, and they understand, again, cricket, we were slightly lucky. January, February, March is not a huge period for us. Outside of indoor practice, but just once it gets a bit brighter in the evenings and it gets a bit warmer, the cricket season kicks in, no different to tennis or golf. And everyone I spoke to this week and the parents who are all involved are delighted that the kids are out of the house and they're away from the computers and the Game Boys, and they're out playing sport, which is only a good thing.
You mentioned competition and the lack thereof at the moment, but obviously everyone will be hoping to get back to a little bit of that soon. What is the plan on that? When does the league normally start, or what league are you going to try and produce over this summer?
Yeah, normally for junior players, they'd start with their school's cricket, which would be straight after Easter, so they'd get a six-week season. It's fairly short, but primary schools and secondary schools would play those competitions. And then the players drift into the club scene, which starts probably early June. So you're getting the better the weather. It's a bit warmer. The pitches, the conditions are a bit better. The facilities are better. So my understanding is on the 7th of June, we can get back playing competitive games. That starts at club level. And then the provincial cricket, which I'm involved with, boys program under 11s all the way up to under 17s. That will really kick in once secondary school finishes on the 4th of June. So we'll have trips up north, we'll have trips down to Cork. Our trips over to England have just been stalled for obvious reasons for the moment, but we just got to bide our time on that and get these players playing some competitive cricket towards the latter part of the summer.
And is there any plans in there? I know you mentioned travel to UK's back, but were there international competitions that were due to take place, and are they still on the cards if restrictions are lifted?
Yeah, normally what happens is we might go to Scotland or Holland during the summer. That'd be at Irish level. Again, there's a window in August. They're looking. Our under-19s are involved in a World Cup qualifier in Scotland in August. So the boys at that age group are they're not too sure where they stand. So from a training point of view, it's all systems ahead, and they've got to be ready if it does go ahead. We normally head over to England. Maybe on the ferry or the flights, and you get some very good standard games over there. The facilities are excellent. The weather's very good. We have a strong link with South Africa as well. We send boys in transition year over there in January. We get them into schools playing cricket over there at a very high standard. So they go out for 8 or 9 weeks. And that link now has just been cut for the moment. But with a bit of luck, we'll be able to kickstart that again the following January and get some more players over there. And it's just a great experience for them to see, to play in a different environment, a different culture, different religion, different languages. They come back as better people and better players.
Breen, I want to take you back, and if you can remember, because I find it difficult myself, to pre-COVID times. But cricket had been experiencing somewhat of a growth explosion in those times. Obviously, you know, we had stars, the likes of Ed Joyce and the international team that had been doing very well, that were becoming more and more household names. How had that affected the growth of the game?
Yeah, no, definitely. You're going back to 2007 at World Cups where we played in the West Indies, and in 2011 when we beat England in Bangalore, and Kevin O'Brien was the hero that day, and Kevin's still playing very good cricket at the moment. So after that, we definitely attracted a lot of people into the game. There's a big Asian community in Ireland now who are taking up cricket and setting up their own clubs. So that's really helped participation numbers. The Irish team is a fully professional team. They travel the world playing, and the better the results they get, the more headlines they get, and that can only benefit people reading newspapers or looking at highlight packages to attract people more people into the game.
And alongside that, then again, we're talking about women's sport in a lot over this COVID. We've seen an explosion in the amount of sport that women are getting involved in, and I'm sure cricket is no different, is it?
Yeah, no, definitely. Our girls are out in action today in Castlenock College in West Dublin, and we've got under-11s, under-13s, under-15s involved. They will play in school. They won't play matches in school, but they will train in school right up until the end of May. And then we've got a Super 2 series, which is involved on Sundays over the next 6 weeks. So that's the best 22 cricketers in the country. They play a series, which all the games are live streamed. You can see them online. So, yeah, the girls' program, very much part of what we do, and trying to encourage more girls into the game.
Sounds brilliant, Brian. Well, there's no doubt, very, very exciting developments coming up. You said June, you're hoping that you'll get back on the 2nd or 7th, is it, for the competition?
Yeah, the plan of action is for matches, for competitive games, is the 7th. The bank holiday Monday is the 7th of June, so our league will probably start the following week. So that Monday might be used for friendlies, just get a bit of batting practice, a bit of bowling practice, and then the season proper will start the following weekend. They're the plans at the moment, just fingers crossed. All goes well between now and then, and we can have a similar cricket season to last year, because it was very similar last year. I think it was the 10th of June we started, and we went right through till the middle of September, so we actually had a decent season, all things considered.
No doubt, you'll be up to your eyes trying to plan and fixtures and locations. I'd say it's going to be hectic.
Yeah, well, we've planned all winter, but you sort of have a plan A and a plan B and a plan C. You don't really know which one to go with, but all systems ahead now. At least we have a date. The government has given us a date, so we can plan ahead for the 7th of June, and things get a bit warmer then, and the pitches get a bit better, and you get a few spectators down watching games when the weather's good, so hopefully that will all go in our favour.
Excellent stuff. Well, Brian, it's been great chatting to you. Really appreciate you keeping us up to date on everything that's happening with Leinster and indeed the national cricket. Good luck with it all. Good luck with the opening and good luck with the return.
No problem, Reggie. Thank you.
Thanks very much. That's Brian O'Rourke there, who is the Leinster Development Manager with Cricket Ireland. And he just giving us all the details. That is great news to think that it might be coming back. It feels funny, you know. I was sitting here last week, we didn't know what was going on, we didn't know what sport was going to be coming back, and a week later, after the announcement on Thursday, everything just feels like it's starting up again. It's real feel good. It's been an amazing couple of days, even just since that announcement, the way people's moods have changed and the reaction to it. You can hear it there in Breen's voice, and you can hear it and think about it in everything that all sport is trying to do across the board. It just feels like we're really are coming out of this thing, and a return to normality. Hopefully someday soon we'll actually get to go and witness some of these sports firsthand and see people taking part in it. I know my own lads getting back training this week, it meant a huge amount to them, and you can see a lift in them the whole way through. So I'm sure that's the same right across the board for whatever sport you're into. It's time to turn our attention to horse racing now. I'm delighted to be joined by Andrew Blair-White, racing pundit and contributor with the Racing Post. Morning, Andrew. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very good, Reggie. How are you?
I'm very good indeed. Thank you very much. It's been a great week, a busy week. I was watching closely last weekend the predictions that you gave us and the bits and pieces, and I was watching a good bit of Punchestown during the week as well. It's been a busy week, no question about it, but a brilliant festival as well in Punchestown.
Yeah, it's been absolutely fantastic. Look, the last week of National Hunt Racing for us jump racing fans, and Willie Mullins has had a stranglehold over some of his best horses have turned up in spades. The likes of Chacan Pourceois, Classical Dream, Energamine, Gallard de Menil have all won Grade 1s. And as a result, both Patrick Mullins and Paul Townend have been able to secure their respective jockeys' championships. He's still got a few more chances today, Willie Mullins, but it has been his festival. 32 races ran, and he's won 16 of them, so it's a bizarre one. I know Willie won, I think, 18 races at the festival a couple of years ago, and I don't think people ever thought that could be surpassed, and he goes into today needing just 3 to surpass that, so it would be absolutely astounding if he was to, and a credit to Willie and his whole team.
Yeah, and of course you mentioned Paul Townend, injured for quite a while as well. So coming back, he came straight back into a winner, didn't he?
He did indeed, yeah. He got a bad fall at the Fairy House Easter Festival off a horse in the Grade 2 Novices Hurdle, and it's been a fight against time to get him back. He did miss the Aintree Grand National meeting, and I don't think he's even quite right, actually, this week, Reggie. He's been very selective with his rides. He's only ridden one horse yesterday. He's only got one ride today as well. But he's been very selective and has been very lucky with the rides he has chosen. As I say, some of those horses I've mentioned there, Chacun Pour Soi, Energamine and Gallard de Menil being three of his main ones, and they've all delivered for him. And he went into the week kind of only three or four ahead of Rachel Blackmore, and the Jockeys' Championship looked like it was well and truly on the line, but he's quickly put that to bed, and I'm sure he'll now have a rest-up period. I know these jump jockeys get around a month off, and then he can regroup and go about retaining his Jockeys' Championship next season.
Very good. We have to mention, of course, people, they talk about Henry de Bromhead and Rachel Blackmore, and oftentimes they forget to mention the horse, of course, who does all the hard work. I mean, you're looking at Honeysuckle. That's 12 races unbeaten, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Oh, she's absolutely unbelievable, Reggie. Yesterday, she probably wasn't even at her best, and she's still gone and won and beaten Sharjah. She's just got so much natural ability for a mare, and I know people are potentially trying to compare her to Dawn Run and seeing whether she will go over a fence, and will we ever see her in a Gold Cup in years gone by. I'm not sure whether that's going to happen or not, but I can't see what beats her in next year's Champion Hurdle. She's getting this £7 mare's allowance, which seems ridiculous for a horse as good as her, that she's getting £7 from the geldings. But she was absolutely super at Cheltenham. I think she was the performance of the week for me at Cheltenham. And even though probably not on her 100% A game, she still got the job done very impressively yesterday. And I know Henry's horses maybe have been under a little bit of a cloud this week, and it just goes to show these good horses can sometimes get you out of trouble even when you're maybe not having your best week. Henry and Rachel obviously had such a good Cheltenham, and Honeysuckle has been able to transform and keep going and win at Punchestown as well.
I thought it was nice when Rachel was interviewed how she actually maybe alluded to the fact that she's not perfect, that she made a couple of mistakes, and that the horse actually dragged her out of it. Or I think she said, what was it, the quote? I nearly threw it away, she said, but the Honeysuckle managed to pull me out and got me out of jail. I thought that was great to hear Rachel talking that way.
Yeah, it is. And look, these jockeys are such humble people. I think horse racing can be such a levelling game, especially jumps racing, considering, you know, on average, once every 12 rides, these jockeys fall. I don't think it's a game you can get too far ahead of yourself, but Rachel's just the model of a humble woman, you know. And to be honest, I think she's a bit more critical on herself than the rest of us would be. I didn't see her doing too much wrong yesterday. Now, she did send Honeysuckle on plenty soon, but look, she's been a fantastic rider for a few years now. This year's been a super year. And I think the rise of Honeysuckle as a horse has been the kind of the pinnacle of the whole Henry and Rachel story. She was the mare that really kind of brought them to prominence, and it's been a fantastic story. And the longer Honeysuckle can stay unbeaten, the better it is for jumps racing.
Absolutely. Okay, well, it's Punchestown is the big one that we're going to look at today, obviously. What stands out for you this week?
Well, a couple of the big races. The Mayor's Champion Hurdle is a very interesting race between Concertista and Stormy Ireland, again, both of Willie Mullins. Hard to split the two. Perhaps go Stormy Ireland is the likelier one, just at a bigger price I'd be siding with him. Then there's the four-year-old hurdle. Sees the first, third and fourth of the Triumph Hurdle at Cheltenham re-oppose each other. So some great racing, Reggie. In terms of my lucky 15 for the day, and hopefully we can bang in a winner or two. In the 2:15, there's a cross-country race. I quite like an old stager in this, Alpha Dezo Bo. You can currently get around 5-2 about him. He was actually running on Thursday in the Latouche Cup, which is a big cross-country race, and he got carried out at a very early stage. One of the other jockeys took the wrong route and carried him out, which was awfully unfortunate. But he's run some good races in these type of events. I think he'll go very close. In the 2:50, it's a big staying handicap chase, 3 miles, 7 furlongs, one to have a cup of tea for. But Mr. Fogpatches went over to the Scottish Grand National only a couple of weeks ago and ran a very good race to come third, despite not jumping maybe great. He's 6-1 in this. 6-1's maybe a little bit short for people to back each way, but I think he's got a massive chance. The 4 o'clock, which is the aforementioned four-year-old hurdle, I quite like Zana here in this. He was fourth in the Triumph hurdle, and he was a little bit disappointing. He went in there, I think an awful lot of people thought he was going to get the job done. He got beaten by Quilixios and Houghton Colour, who he does have to reverse the form with. But I think a slightly tighter track might see this horse to actually better effect. Denise Foster's horses have been a bit in and out this week, but you're getting around 7-2 about him, which I feel is overpriced to potentially reverse that form with Quilixios and Houghton Colour. And the final one, the 5:40, a tricky mare's handicap hurdle, but I'm trying to give you one at a bigger price. A mare called Socially Distant for Paul Nolan and Brian Cooper. Off a mark of 109 here. I think they were desperately disappointed that she got beaten at Wexford the last day. She was a little too keen over 3 miles. She stepped back down in trip today, and I think a big field handicap could suit her as well. She's as big as 12-14-1. So if she was to go in, we'd have a very good Saturday.
Excellent stuff. Okay, note of those. There's a bit of racing going on across the water as well. Is there anything there that stood out to you?
Yeah, well, the 2000 Guineas is at Newmarket, which is the big first classic of the year for flat racing fans. The Guineas itself is an awfully tricky race from a punting point of view. Two, I wouldn't mind at maybe each way prices would be Jesse Harrington's horse Lucky Vega. Does have to prove whether he gets the mile, but ran a great race in the Middle Park at the end of last year over 6 furlongs. And Poetic Flair for Jim Bulger. Jim Bulger rarely just throws a horse into the Guineas for the sake of it. This horse won his trial at Leopardstown a few weeks ago. He won the Killavullen Stakes at Leopardstown at the end of last year. I think you can get the two of them both at double figure prices, Reggie, and I take both of them each way in what looks a very open renewal.
Aidan O'Brien, of course, has a good record in the 2000 Guineas. Wembley, he has Wembley running.
Yeah, he does. He's three or four of them running. Wembley looks the pick. Ryan Moore, who's the stable jockey, has picked him. Look, he ran a very good race and second in the Dewhurst to St. Mark's Basilica. He seems to take to the track. You'd wonder whether he's just got a few too many twos to his name. I don't know whether he's quite got it in him to go and do it. Battleground, maybe the one that I'd be siding with out of the O'Brien quartet. Frankie Dettori's on this one, and Frankie obviously loves the big occasion and the big day. And this horse was very impressive early as a two-year-old last year, and was a little bit unlucky when they brought him over to America at the back end of the season. He might be one of the O'Brien lot that might go the closest.
Okay, he's got his eyes on lots of things, I see, as well. He's got Mogul running in the Prix Ghanéen at Longchamp in the 3:15 as well, but that's one he gives a fair chance to two.
Yeah, Mogul is a very interesting horse going forward this year as a four-year-old. He blew off the cobwebs with a run over in Maidan in Dubai a couple of weeks ago and should strip fitter. He won a Group 1 over in France last year. He's a really, really good horse and certainly one to keep the right side of. I suspect the long-term aim with a horse like him will be getting him back over there in late October for the Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe, and this would be a good stepping stone towards that.
Okay, very good. We've got some stuff at Sligo. You probably haven't had a chance to look at that yet, have you?
No, I'm trying to hold on to the Punchestown jump racing. It's the last day, and I would be a little bit more of a jumps fan than a flat fan, so I'm holding on to that. The Sligo racing, I did have a quick look at, and it's very tricky. So the only thing I could advise would be small stakes to anyone that's having a punt on that.
It's all tricky to me, if you ask me. There's no question about it. What, any other news that's been standing out this week for you?
Look, it's really been all centred around Punchestown and Willie Mullins and Paul Townend. What's been great, actually, for the game is that the English, who obviously didn't have the greatest Cheltenham Festival, they've come over and won 3 races at this Punchestown Festival, which I think is actually very important for the game. I know Ruby Walsh has said this week how the Irish need the English and the English need the Irish, and it is like that. But Paul Nicholls has come over and he's won 2 races, including the big Punchestown Gold Cup with Clan des Oboes, who's a phenomenal horse. He's won 2 King Georges. He just doesn't act around Cheltenham, which is an awful shame for such a good horse. But he beat Album Photo, the 2-time Gold Cup winner in the Punchestown Gold Cup, and also David Maxwell rode Bob and Co. to win the big Hunter's Chase yesterday. He beat Patrick Mullins in a thrilling finish. And considering David Maxwell is a really an amateur, he puts all his money into the game to own a few horses, and he rides them himself. More luck to him, and he produced a very good ride to get Bob and Co up. So I think it's quite good for the equality of the game, probably, that that England have come over and had a bit of success with their runners, and they've a few interesting ones today as well.
Absolutely. Well, certainly looking forward to it. There's no question about it. There's plenty for us to keep our eye on. Andrew, as always, been great chatting to you. We'll catch up with you again next week, and good luck with your picks for this week.
Thanks, Reggie.
Thank you very much. That's Andrew Blair-White there, who, of course, is the Racing Pundit and Racing Post contributor as well, giving us his picks for the week and his standout features. And would say that his lucky 15 is coming from Punchestown. So the 215 is Alpha Dezo Bo. That's in the 215. In the 250, it's Mr. Fog Patches. Then we have the 4 o'clock Zanahir and the 5:40 Socially Distant. They're his picks on the lucky 15. So just want to keep a quick mention as well. I didn't mention it in the headlines earlier on, of course, about the boxing. Katie Taylor taking on Natasha Jonas. That's going to be absolutely intriguing, that game to see, or that fight to see which way it goes. I mean, I think they obviously it's a rematch of the Olympic fight that they had, but I think Jonas has certainly stepped up a little bit since then. But there's no question Katie Taylor has too. So her form and the way that she's been since turning pro, and the way that she's worked. And I watched the press conference during the week. I don't know if anybody saw it, but you could see just how much respect there was there for Katie Taylor from Natasha Jonas and from her corner, as they were talking about the fact that Katie is the one who's basically been the trailblazer for women's boxing. And brought it to the stage now where they were even saying that, you know, a lot of the male boxers love just watching the women's boxing, and up to 5 years ago they wouldn't have even dreamt of it. So that just gives you an idea of how far it has come along. So we want to wish Katie the very, very best, of course, in that fight tonight, that she gets the result. We'd really love to see her getting that. So good luck to Katie on that. Had a text in from Derek in Swords. Good morning, Reggie. Remind Ken to congratulate him that this day 24 years ago he won the World Championships, the same day as my daughter was born in Conway's. I was in Conway's watching the last few frames in the bar awaiting the arrival. That's Derek and Soren. So happy birthday to your daughter. And yes, Ken, congratulations. 24 years doesn't seem that long ago at all. Time to turn our attention now to rugby. Delighted to be joined on the line by the one and only Shane Byrne. Good morning, Shane. How are you?
Morning, Reg. All good, man.
Good. Thanks for joining us this morning. Always great to have you on. We'll start with last night, I suppose, and a disappointing result for Ulster.
Oh, very disappointing, and particularly the manner of it. They had an absolutely superb first half. They, with ball in hand, they just attacked fantastically and had Leicester all over the place. Leicester, their defences are 6 and 7s. They gave away a yellow card. And Ulster took full advantage of it all, and then it was like someone flipped the switch the other way in the second half, and the complete opposite happened. Leicester came out, attacked everything. Ulster never got their hands on the ball, and they just never got back into the game. They had a bit of a pushback late in the game, but it was just too little too late. It was very, very disappointing, because you can see that they're playing some fantastic attack in rugby. And when they did finally get their hands on the ball in the second half, they did brilliantly with it. But it was just so late in the game. And, really, really disappointing. A huge opportunity there to get into a European Cup final for them.
I felt exactly the same way. I was looking at a few comments. Even Stephen Ferris was saying it, a few tweets that he was putting out. He reckoned that Ulster were going to put 30 points on Leicester. It seemed like they were so in control, 11 points in the lead at half time. And, you would think that they were going to get the job done, but just fell apart. It's kind of not good enough for Ulster at this stage either, you know?
No, very disappointing. And, like, we've all been involved in games like that where mentally something goes wrong at half time, you don't come out in the second half ready to go, fully cocked to keep the pressure on, and that's what happened. And you know, whatever Borthwick said to the Leicester team at half time, they came out firing, they made changes, and they just got stuck in. And, you know, they also just couldn't get their hands on the ball. The possession stats were wily in favour of Leicester, and mostly throughout the second half. And, yeah, they've really got to be disappointed in what they did, because they were sacrificing the game line too easy. And when a lot of their pressure they were putting on was through a very, very hard up defence. But you've got to hand it to George Ford and, you know, guys like that on the team. They really pulled it out of the bag. And Stockdale, I thought, made a few mistakes in defence as well. And, look, all in all, it was totally in their hands. And you wouldn't mind Ferris saying things like that, because going from the first half, it totally looked that that was what was going to happen. Leicester just didn't have an answer. And Ulster went to sleep.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's been the story of Ulster for a while now. And, you know, just when you think they're getting to grips with things, they kind of let it blow. They blow it. And, I think it's... I'd say from an Ulster perspective, fans-wise, and... you know, people who are in the hierarchy in the game, the frustration levels now at this stage, they're kind of getting out there. They need to grasp every opportunity to get a bit of silverware, and that was one. You get that, you know, level away from home, real opportunity to get silverware, set up a final berth for yourself. I think that's frustrating. I wonder how it's going to spill out.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see what comes from this, because there's no doubt they have the team to win silverware, and you could see from the way they were playing they have the ability to do it, but something mentally, you know, didn't see it through. And they're the things that worry a team, because, you know, and the people who would be in charge, is that, like, they've built the structure, they have the team, they have everything you need, you just need to do it in the park. And if they're not doing it on the park, yeah, eyebrows need to be raised.
Yeah, no doubt they will be asking those questions. Okay, let's turn our attention to tomorrow's big game, all the chat about it. I don't think I can ever remember. I'm looking at the Irish Indo front page today of the Sport, and it's O'Gara versus Leinster, the next chapter. And there's pictures of the 2006 game that I was involved in, the 2009 game that I wasn't. You know, it's mad the way the press have jumped on this Ronan O'Gara versus Leinster, and Ronan O'Gara's La Rochelle, isn't it?
It is. It's totally understandable, though. You know what I mean? It's everybody. Ronan just has the attention of everybody around. Like, his progress through coaching has been very, very smart. You know as well as I do, he's a very smart man, and he doesn't do things by half. And he's doing it very, very well at the moment. He's slowly but surely just getting more and more experience, climbing up the ladder, resisting any temptations to come back and step into Munster or Ireland or anything like that, just doing his own thing. And everybody's really watching how he's getting on, and he's doing brilliantly well, you have to say. Like, you know, the talk from the players and everything, that anyone who discusses about how he is getting on actually doing the coaching, it's very, very positive. And he's brought this La Rochelle side, you know, and he's going to become the head coach now. He's brought this La Rochelle side, you know, to new levels, and it's great to see. It really is. Listen, like most French sides, they have a lot of outside influence. They have some absolutely superb players, but it's what he is getting them to the level that you'd be very sure that his knowledge of Leinster will come into this, that they would feel that they have a little added extra that they can bring to the table because Ronan's there, and everybody's watching to see how that's going to play out.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. It's an interesting team, all right. There's a real mix of sort of foreigners and home. As you said, Ronan's becoming the head coach in the next season. He's going to be the main boss there as John O'Gibbs moves on to Claremont. So it'll be the Ronan show completely then at that stage. But it's whether or not this La Rochelle, as he said himself, they haven't kind of gotten to this stage or this level before, La Rochelle. They'd love to have the crowd there. They'd love to have everything that goes along with that. But Leinster are so experienced in this area, albeit they're up against a very good, in-form La Rochelle. A lot of people still feel that Leinster will get the job done.
I do too. I think the way they played on
against Exeter, you know, after going 14-0 down. The way they got hold of that game again and you know, really, I don't want to say stranglehold because, you know, they played fantastic rugby right the way throughout of it, is that that's what they need to bring to this this game against La Rochelle. And the fact is that it does count. You and I know it does count. When you haven't been in scenarios like this, there'll be little moments in the games that will have huge effect. And Leinster's experience will definitely count in that. But, you know, the caveat here is that this side will be supremely prepared for a side who haven't been here before. And our Leinster will have to be playing as well as they played against Exeter to win this game. But it's well within them to do that. You know, the big battle to me is what changed the game the last day was the back row. I think Ruddock, Van der Fleer and Cohen were just absolutely outstanding. And they'll have a hell of a battle, you know, this against Ulrich, Vito and Liebenberg, who are an absolutely amazing back row as well. And whoever gets on top of that battle, I think, would be a mini example of how the game's going to go.
Yeah, particularly the Conan battle against Vito, I think that is going to be immense. I'm just so impressed with Jack Conan. I think he's a phenomenal rugby player. He does so much hard work, but also, like, it's not just the glamour stuff. He carries very well. He does all that kind of stuff, but he's doing the dog work all the time as well. He's in his right position at eight. You know, there's no messing around with other back row combinations there. He's just an out-and-out number eight. Plays brilliant rugby and very exciting to watch.
He's one of these guys that, there's a few now as well, but he's one of these guys having a superb end of season. The way this crazy season has gone because of COVID has actually suited him down to the ground. He is absolutely in top form. Like, he's playing his best rugby. I've never seen him, I don't think, play as well as he is now. And but added to that, you know, Ruddock, I think, look, we all know Ruddock has been fantastic. He just doesn't get the plaudits that he should get. He's just one of those players, we've all known lads like that, that just are amazing week in, week out, never let anyone down and just never seems to get up with Ireland regularly or anything like that. And to me, Van der Fleer is superb. I think he adds more than any other seven that we have at the moment available. And, you know, it's absolutely superb. And add to that, you know, the back line, we've come out all guns blazing with the back line. Robbie Henshaw in the form of his life. Great to see Gary Wingrose back. You know, and I think genuinely against Exeter, Ross Byrne, it's been a long time coming, but I think that transition is happening. I think Ross Byrne took a step against Exeter. He was absolutely superb. So I don't think that anything is going to be left behind by him being on that pitch.
Well, arguably, the game improved when he came on against Exeter, and there was a lot of heads went down when Johnny Sexton was going off injured, and the worry, first of all, that it was another injury to him, but secondly, that what's that going to do to affect the team in a game that they were under so much pressure? But I thought the way Ross Byrne, and like, what I couldn't believe during the week either, Shane, is it's his 100th game.
It's incredible, isn't it?
How did that happen so quick?
I know, it's incredible. It took me 10 years, I think, to get 100 caps with Leinster. It is incredible. And he's been always just tipping away in the background and just getting on, getting his games going. He's massive experience at this point. You know, I know we all, it's because when there's the shadow cast by Johnny Sexton is very, very large. And I suppose he's just been working away in the background there, but what it's ended up with is a guy who is, to me, is ready, and he's massive experience already, and if he needs to step into those shoes permanently, you know, I'd be perfectly happy with that.
The other person that's having an amazing season, I think, and somewhat quietly has been tipping away as well, as you mentioned there in the background, has been Robbie Henshaw. His form has been phenomenal.
Incredible. I think he's one of the best players around anywhere at the moment. You know, Northern Hemisphere, even further afield, he has just been incredible. His tenacity, his aggression in defence, his read of play, his skills, everything you need from a centre, he has it in absolute spades, and he's playing fantastic stuff. Like, single-handedly, you know, he nailed down the back line against, you know, against Exeter. It seemed to just spark it off, and everyone else fed off it. And that's what you want. And that's back to when, you know, the greats like O'Driscoll were playing. That's so important to have someone like that, because you do feed off that. And if a guy like that beside you is just showing you the way, no hesitation. I love that. It's a great statement in rugby, because there's so many things happen in rugby, and it can make you hesitate for that millisecond. And these people who just don't have any hesitation, just react and go for it, like Henshaw does, particularly in defence, it's fantastic to see, and it's so great to play alongside someone like that.
What way do you see it going? What do Leinster have to do to get this victory away from home?
Yeah, at a bare minimum, it's all the old cliches. It's retain possession. I certainly wouldn't be kicking too much possession away against these guys. But it is the cliche of slow the ball up. Meet them physically in the pack. I think we have the pack to do that. But it's do not give them fast ball on their home turf, and make everything difficult for them. And just control the game as they did against Exeter. Like, they, you know, Exeter was the great example of, looking back at that first 10, 15-ish minutes, you could go, that's how not to play. That's exactly what you don't do. And everything they did for the rest of that game is exactly what they need to do to win this game, because it will come to the point, if the pressure is on La Rochelle, you know, you've said it, we'll repeat it again, they haven't been in this scenario before. And the pressure will tell. If Leinster are still in this game or slightly nose ahead, you know, as the clock starts ticking away, going deep into the second half, the pressure will come on them. And the experience that Leinster have, that's the time that it really tells.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it'll be interesting to see what way it unfolds. Now, quick chat about the Lions. Gatland will be watching a lot of what's going on this weekend to try and see where he might go. From an Irish perspective, I'm looking at Alan Quinlan's selections here. He's picking Tadhg Furlong, Robbie Henshaw, Gary Ringrose and James Ryan is nailed on. He has should go Johnny Sexton. What's your thoughts on that in terms of the injury concerns around Johnny?
Now, there you go. That, I was exactly going to say that. I'd say if Johnny was playing on Sunday, he would 100% be going. Because it's amazing the turnaround that guys like that have had at the end of the Six Nations meant for them. Conor Murray, I think, is going to go. He's going to benefit massively from that last push that they had in the Six Nations and you know, the way those games went. I think the fact that Johnny Sexton is not playing and still maybe the fragile bit might be coming out, I don't think he's going to get on that plane.
I think it's touch and go from him. I'm not sure. There seems to be more going on around that, and I hate talking around the injuries with Johnny because, you know, we have no idea of what's actually been done medically, and people are offering opinions left, right and centre about what he should and shouldn't do. I mean, it's pretty obvious with what's happened this week that there's nobody taking any stupid risks with Johnny Sexton, and it'll be managed accordingly. It's just whether or not he'd be ready in time, nearly.
Yeah, correct. I know. I don't think there's any doubt that he'd be available. I don't think that's an issue. I just think that you know, it kind of, I don't know. It probably highlights the things that can go wrong with him, because look, he gets targeted, because when he's on the park, he is so very, very important to everything that goes on, and there is no doubt that he would be targeted in South Africa. Like, wouldn't you, if you were playing against them? That would be exactly what they would do. And the thoughts of, you know, he's getting injured quite a bit. You know, nothing particular. Hopefully there's nothing major, nothing serious going on. But it's just, I think if he was playing this weekend, I don't think there would have been any doubt he would definitely been on and challenging. But I think there's a lot of superb outhafs out there. And I think they may get on the seat ahead of him.
Yeah, injuries won't help his cause, all right. A bit of bad news as well, of course, about the Irish tour being cancelled this week to Fiji.
Such a pity, because particularly, you know, the Pacific Islanders, as you know, they're almost the feeder team to so many
fantastic teams around the world, both clubs and internationally, and they need all the attention that they can get. And it's an awful pity. You know, you and I have been toured out there. They're a brilliant place to go. It's amazing experiences, and they need as much, you know, game time as they can get. They're crying out for it. You see it all over social media from the players whenever any attention, anything positive goes. Great news that they're going to be allowed into Super Rugby, a team is, and, you know, that's the kind of things that have to happen. So it's an awful pity for things that happen. But this is COVID. You know, unfortunately, all rhyme and reason is out the window at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, Shane, as always, pleasure talking to you. Really enjoyed that chat. Enjoy the game. Hopefully we'll get the result that we want tomorrow.
Please, guys. Take care, man.
That's Shane Byrne there, of course, former Ireland, Leinster and Lions legend, giving us his thoughts on the game tomorrow as Leinster take on La Rochelle in the Champions Cup. Now, I'm delighted to introduce a new contributor to the show, Deirdre Smith. She's one of Ireland's leading golf amateurs, currently playing off a handicap of +3, which I find really annoying, but I'm sure she doesn't mind one bit. Deirdre, you're very welcome to the show.
Morning, Reggie. Thanks very much. Delighted to be part of the setup or to contribute this morning.
Wonderful, wonderful. Just to give you a little introduction and a bit of background yourself, you're a school teacher, but also took up golf a number of years back and took it by storm. Fell in love with it, playing off +3, and of course an Irish Championship winner as well.
Yeah, look, I suppose I played a lot of sport at junior level and in all different types of sport and camogie and Gaelic. I came from the heart of the country and golf wasn't part of what we did, and my parents didn't play golf. So when I started to teach here in Dundalk, I just got introduced to the game and fell in love with it and loved it and put in the hard work. And you know, when you do that, I suppose you get the rewards. Well, sometimes you do, but luckily I did. I think if you stick at it long enough and you're resilient. And I had enough experience from other sports that I kind of was able to transfer those skills over. And it's something that I think we should be doing a bit more of, is maybe getting a lot of, you know, women who played other sports to take up golf when their careers finish. And I think that they could make a great success of it.
Absolutely.
So I just fell in love with the game, really, Reggie. And that's really the most important thing.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, falling in love with sport is what will do it for you. There's no question about it. And there has been a real uptake in women's golf in particular. I suppose over the years, there's always been stigmas attached with golf courses and women's involvement with it and everything else. But quality and everything else that has come in recent years have made it much more accessible. And we're seeing an awful lot of that coming through now with the performances recently as well in the LPGA events, Stephanie Meadow and the likes of Leona Maguire.
Yeah, absolutely, Reggie. It's this is what really we've been waiting for years, to be honest. You know, we've had it in the men's game with Harrington and McDowell and obviously Rory and Clark. And, you know, once Harrington won a major, you know, the floodgates opened, and, you know, we desperately want to win on the LPGA. And if we could get that, and I think we're really within touch and distance of that at the moment. You know, Leona's performance there recently in the Lotto Championship at tied second. And I think she will drive Stephanie on as well. I think having the two of them will be fantastic. And, you know, Leona has always sort of, you know, done things incrementally, and she has reached all her targets and stages. She's had an unbelievable amateur career. You know, she has the longest record for being number one amateur in the world. You know, and she's gone toe-to-toe with these girls who are playing on the LPGA Tour at college level. So, you know, she's standing up on the first tee in a professional event, and you know, she's no fear. She's beaten them at amateur level, so I've no doubt that she will go on to do that, and hopefully Stephanie will you know, ride that wave as well, and we get the two of them there. But I genuinely think we're very close to that, without putting any pressure on them, obviously. But it's really what we need in this country to give Irish golf a great fillip, you know, Irish ladies golf in particular.
And Olivia Mahaffey as well, she had a good performance in Augusta in the women's amateur.
Yeah, and again, that's a really high profile event. And I just read last night that Olivia's turning pro, so that's again now she finished two shots off the lead there, but she was tied ninth, but because there were so many people ahead of her. But she double bogeyed the 12th hole, the famous par 3, which I'm sure she'll rue. But you know, she was very close to winning that championship and got a lot of coverage on Sky with that tournament. So that's the exposure we need to, you know, to inspire more girls from this country to kind of go on and feel that they can compete at that level.
And certainly, you know, I'm conscious as well of people like Katie Taylor, who I mentioned earlier in the show, and also Rachel Blackmore now, who are kind of crossing that divide whereby the gender doesn't come into it as much. And I'm struck that golf is one of those sports that's the same. You know, it's not about gender, it's about skill. So, you know, I can watch the ladies' golf just as easy as the men's because you're looking at the same skill levels.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think obviously, you know, you have DeChambeau, who's sort of, you know, an outlier, who's bombing it, you know, 380 yards or whatever it is, with a swing speed of 133. You know, and women are never going to ever get to that. You know, I don't think they will at the moment. I mean, probably the average swing speed of a female golfer on the US tour is 94. Obviously, you know, there are some at 105 and 110, but. You know, the women are obviously can compete on the same level. I have no doubt I agree with you on that. I was listening to one of the guys at the Palmer Cup this week, Keelan Rafferty, who's one of the top amateurs in Ireland, and he said he played with Olivia Mahaffey in the four ball event at the Palmer Cup. It's an amateur event, and he said there was no difference between the top women and the top men. He could see no difference. So that kind of commentary and that kind of narrative is also very positive.
Excellent stuff. Okay, give me a roundup of what's going on leaderboards-wise with the LPGA and PGA and European Tour. Who's doing well?
At the moment in the men's, Keegan Bradley has shown great form, and he's kind of been in the doldrums a little bit in the last while. He hasn't shown any form, but he's leading to this week in the Valspar Championship at 12 under with 64-66, and then you have Sam Burns and Lucas Glover there, right on. Well, Sam Burns is leading with him. Sorry, he's joint leader at 12 under. And then you have Lucas Glover and Charlie Hoffman and Max Homa, who are at 8 under. And you know, it's a really strong championship. Lots of good players in it. Zach Johnson is there, and Tom Lewis, the English golfer, he's doing well. And Charles Schwartzel, who's again hasn't really shown much form in the last while. So Paul Casey's trying to win that event for the third time, but he's 3 under, so probably a bit too far back to do any, you know, to really charge and maybe win that tournament. I think he'd need to be closer to the leaders to think about that. The LPGA event is actually, they've moved to Singapore this week, so unfortunately we don't have Stephanie or Leona in that event. And the top 69 players in the world are playing in that, so you have Chinese golfer there, Zhu Lin, you know, the Asian golfers, the Asian females are just really dominating. You have 4 of them in the top 10. You have 8 of them in the top 20 of the world rankings. And again, it's no difference this week. You have Inbee Park there and Soyeon Rin and Hydro Kim. They're 3 Korean golfers there in the top 10, right in the thick of it, you know, minus 10, minus 9. Zhu Lin is minus 14. Then you have a nice, you have Inbee Park as well, minus 13. I mean, she's just the danger woman, you know. She's number one ranked player for 4 separate runs. She's 3 majors, you know. She's definitely favoured to win it. She's only 1 behind. But then you have Lydia Ko, who's right in the mix there, minus 10. And she's shown great form recently and, you know, has shot some phenomenal scores there. She's the youngest player ever of either gender to be the number one professional golfer. And she's numerous titles. But yet to win a major, so that's something I'm sure that's on her list. So yeah, that's kind of the LPGA news, and it's moving. It's not going back to the States for a couple of weeks, so I think we might miss Stephanie Leone in an event now until the middle of May, which is you know, a bit disappointing because Leona has shown a lot of form and indeed Stephanie recently. So, and then in the European Tour, you have quite a mix there. German leading it there, Nikolai von Dellinghausen at 16 under, and then you have Pep Anglaise, who's a kind of new name in the field, minus 13. But you know, these guys are coming out on tour and they have no fear, you know. They can win straight off the bat, these guys. You know, like years ago people used to serve their time on tour and you know, it would take them maybe a number of years to find their feet, and it's just not the case anymore. And it's even more so in America, coming off the collegiate, you know, conveyor belt, as I call it. So
plenty
going on. Yeah, and Yeah, the Irish, they're not doing so well. Jonathan Caldwell and Niall Carney made the cut at minus eight and minus four, and a couple of guys missed the cut. Tom McGibbon, who was overlooked for the Walker Cup, didn't make the cut. He had a good first round, but he didn't make the cut. But the standard's so high, it takes time to make the transition sometimes.
In other news then, there's a bit of word, Tiger's rehab seems to be going well. Everybody, of course, waiting to see how he gets on and will he ever get back?
Well, you know, I think he'll get back. I'm not sure we'll ever see the Tiger we saw before. You know, everything's against him in that sense. You know, he's 45 now. You know, he's had a lot of problems with back problems. Now this is going to be a huge setback for him. But I've no doubt he'll get back. I suppose you write him off at our peril. Yeah. You know, he's proven so many times unbelievably resilient. You know, and that skill is that's one of the most important things in golf, because it is such a mentally tough game.
Absolutely.
And I've no doubt that he'll make a comeback. And I think we'd all be cheering if that happened, because I know how we were all so impressed by his 2019 win in Augusta. So we're all behind him, and we're certainly supporting him, and we'll all be wearing a red shirt to support him, I'm sure.
Absolutely. I don't know if I'll be wearing a red shirt now, you know, I can't push it that far. It doesn't suit me too well. Talking about a human story, decent human story, the Michael Vizhakis qualification, emotional qualification for his first PGA event. A lot of resilience and sacrifice needed to get there.
Yeah, look, this was one of the kind of the lighter moments this week. You know, the sheer emotion when he qualified on Monday to play in the Valspar. And you know, he went on to birdie the first hole. Now, unfortunately, he didn't make the cut. He shot 74 and then 71, so he missed the cut by four shots. But so many people tweeted about that. The story really resonated. And look, we all know what it takes to get to the top, and we all know the sacrifice and the work and the effort and the blood, sweat and tears. So it really, really, people really could relate to the story and the sacrifices that his parents had made from when he was 8 years of age. And just the relief that you've achieved something that you've dreamt about all your life. And that's really what he said. And, you know, his parting shot at the press conference was to keep on fighting. And, you know, if you have that kind of resilience, you know, sometimes you learn to know how to get the thing done if you do it often enough. And I think that was a really good story. And he one of the other things he said was that a lot of people give up on their dreams. Mm. You know, and he said, I didn't, not for one second did I ever think about quitting. And, you know, he's a real role model for all of us, or for any sports person who's doubting themselves. If you really want it badly enough, you know, you've just got to keep going and grinding out week in, week out.
Yep, absolutely. Okay, Deirdre, been great chatting to you. We'll catch up with you again shortly. Thanks for all that update on the golf, and we'll chat again soon.
Great, Reggie. Thanks very much.
Take care. That's Deirdre.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Deirdre Smith there, our golf correspondent, giving us all the latest news and headlines of what's happening around the world with that. Time for football now. Delighted to be joined on the line by Alan Cawley. Good morning, Al. How are you?
Good morning, Reg. I'm good, thanks. Yourself?
Oh, very well. Never better. You know yourself.
Come on.
It's a beautiful day, and there's been great football going on as well. None more so than the Pats game last night. Actually, Declan Drake caught up with Stephen O'Donnell and asked him about the week ahead. Let's have a listen to that.
There's no big one, really. They're all big ones. You know, as you see today, they're all very competitive games, and our attention now switches to Monday down in Sligo. Always a very tough place to go, so you know, we get recovery over the weekend and then we roll on. And we're happy with our start, but we still know that there's masses of improvement left in us. Like, you know, we know we can get a lot better. So that's what's probably more pleasing and should really, you know, excite our players, is that we know we can improve massively, but we've got a good result tonight and we kick on again now to Monday.
Well, they're only going to improve massively. They've 3-0 win away at home last night to Longford Town, and they're top of the table. That's not a bad position to be in as a manager.
Manager speak, Reggie. That's what that is. They're all the same. But no, Stephen's a great lad. He's done a great job, to be fair, Reggie. And it's taken him a bit of time, but I felt it would since he went in. But he recruited the players that he wanted in the off-season there, and he got offloaded the ones he didn't want. And now he's putting his stamp on the team, and he can see it every week at the performances. And as you say, to win 3-0 last night was an outstanding result. And it carries on the great form. There's 20 points now in 24. So they have had a brilliant start, right up there with Shamrock Rovers. The question now for them is kind of sustain it. And I think they can, Reggie, to be fair. Like, you listen to Stephen there, and
he's not one for resting on his laurels. I know that from knowing him as a player, and he'll certainly be driving them on. And as you heard in the interview, he's obviously talking about the improvements that can be made. So there's always improvements to be made. And if they keep up the run of form that they're at the moment, I do think they'll sustain the challenge.
Yeah, the challenge is mainly coming from Rovers now at this stage, who are sitting up there in the same points at them with 20 points and a good win for them against Finn Harps, albeit they might have been expected that, but Finn Harps sitting in fourth position have had a good start to the season as well. So Rovers hot on their heels though.
Yeah, they are, and to be fair to Rovers, as we said all along, they're the favourite, Shamrock Rovers, and they're entitled to be up there where they are. So they have 20 points also, but they haven't hit the heights that they did last year maybe, but they're still picking up the points and picking up the results, which is always a sign of a good team. And as you say, it's up to Ballybuffet last night, and they won quite comfortably in the end. So it was a good win for them as well. And they're beginning to pull away already. Like, it's only 8 games in, but Pats and Shamrock Rovers have opened up a little bit of a gap already to third place. And if you look down to fourth end, there's another 9-point gap. So there's a little bit of a gap opening up. But just to go back to the Pats thing as well, Reggie, sorry, I don't know if people got a chance to see Chris Forrester's goal, but they should check it out, because it's another one to add to his collection, and he's playing some brilliant stuff, and it's great to see him back at the level that we all know he can play at.
Absolutely, yeah. I haven't seen it myself. I'll check it out later on. The other one, of course, then, typical if you're a Bows supporter, you'll have your head in your hands a lot of the time, but losing at home to Derry City, who weren't really having a great run of form at the moment, is another big blow.
No, it's a huge blow, and I was in at that match. I was in Dalymount last night, and to be fair to Bows, they started the game really well, and they were well on top. They got the penalty, they went 1-0 up, and then, to be fair to Derry, they came back into it towards the latter part of the first half. But in the second half, Derry showed a lot of character and resilience. They got the equaliser from a set piece, a good goal, McJanet. But then Bowles totally switched off from a free right at the end. And Keith Long will be kicking himself, as the players will as well. And they allowed McJanet so much time that he could have actually taken it down and put it in. But he hit it first time and scored. And it was a huge win for Derry, coming off the back of a huge win for them last week in Rory Higgins' first game as well. So that's two wins on the bounce. And as you said before that, Derry were struggling to get any points, and now they have two wins back to back, so it's a brilliant start for Roy Higgins. But it's a bit worrying for Bohemians. That's their fifth loss in 8 games, Reggie. They certainly haven't had the start that we all expected, and they played so well up in Tala last week. I was raving about them last week, even though they lost, but they played so well against Shamrock Rovers, and I thought they'd follow that up the following week in the game last night and get the 3 points against Derry, but they slipped up again. And as I say, that's worrying times now, 5 defeats out of 8 games.
The other team I want to mention is Sligo. Now, if we had been saying that Sligo were going to go away and get a draw in Drogheda maybe last season or the season before, you'd have been biting the arm off for that. But the way they've been going lately, they'll probably be disappointed.
Yeah, I think they'll be disappointed, Reggie, because if you have aspirations to stay up near the top of the league, you need to be beating Drogheda games like that. But to be fair, Drogheda have had a decent start, and their plucky opposition, Tim Clancy, has done a great job there. And they have had a decent start considering they just got promoted. But from Sligo's point of view, especially coming off the back of a defeat last week against Derry, I was expecting a big reaction for them to go and beat Drogheda, but they slipped up and they only drew, as you say, 1-1. It still keeps them up in around third. I said all along anyway, Reggie, even when there was a bit of hype about them at the start of the season and the good start, I always felt they were only playing for European positions really, and I never felt for a second that they were going to win the league or that they were contenders to win the league. The start may have kind of may have left people thinking that they might be in with a chance of winning the league, but I never felt that at all. So they're sitting in third. They still have had a good start. I'm sure Liam Buckley will be looking at the positives of that. They have had a good start, but I never felt as though they were going to contend to win the league.
Yeah, okay. Let's move on to across the water, and the of course the Champions League was on during the week. Game, I thought City were going to struggle in this match. I really did, but against PSG, I just felt at home PSG were going to be too strong for them. But that's a hell of a result.
Yeah, and it was a brilliant game, Reggie. It was as good a game as you'd see now. And as I said, we mentioned many times, football can be a hard watch nowadays with all the different silly rules and VAR and all the nonsense that goes on in football nowadays. And it can be a difficult watch, and there's games that frustrate the life out of me because of all the carry-on. But this was absolutely brilliant, and the cream of the crop, really, PSG and Man City. And PSG were absolutely brilliant in the first half, and I felt the same. I thought City are really up against it here. But to be fair to them, in the second half, Reggie, they totally turned around, and they were outstanding in the second half. Got the 2 goals as well. Albeit, I felt the goals were probably gifts. PSG will be disappointed with the concession and the 2 goals. They were sloppy enough on their part. But Man City's play in general was absolutely outstanding in the second half. And But I still think there's plenty left in this tie, Reggie. PSG went to Munich, obviously, in the last round and beat them, so away from home as well, they won in Germany. So they won't hold any fear going to the Etihad, certainly won't, and the way they play as well, with the pace on the counter-attack with Mbappe and Neymar and Di Maria, I still think there's plenty left in this tie, and it should be a cracker on Tuesday night.
It's funny, I'm watching the City team, and the more I've been watching them, the more I just wonder, do they over-rely on De Bruyne? I mean, he got a bit of an injury. They're just not the same team without him, but when he's on the pitch and when he performs, and I mean, getting the goal obviously as well, he seems to be the main man for them every single time.
Yeah, he's their star player, Reggie, and like every team, when you're missing your star player, you're going to look like a different side. But to be fair, the quality all over the pitch, and I think Mahrez has been outstanding. Even when De Bruyne was missing, Gundogan stepped up, to be fair to him. He's probably not played as well in recent weeks since De Bruyne has been back, or certainly not had the impact with the goals, but he was outstanding for a period there. You look at Foden, the emergence of him as well, Reggie, only a kid. He's an unbelievable talent, and he's going to be an absolute superstar as well. And he's been stepping up really with the impact he's been having on the games also. So there's so much quality all over the pitch. And Guardiola, I know people will throw at him, well, look, he has the money to spend on all these top quality players, but you still have to manage them and still have to implement the style of football and the way they play. They're an unbelievable team to watch. But I still think, I felt when PSG had the man sent off, when Paredes got sent off, I thought if City came out of here 3-1, I thought it was a tie over. But at 2-1, I still think there's life left in this, Reggie. Even though City were so good in the second half, I still think there's life left in this tie.
Oh, there has to be, because there's so much quality in that PSG squad. You can't expect they're going to go out with a whimper in what is the biggest, arguably the biggest competition. So there has to be more left in it.
To be fair, PSG in the first half, Reggie, was every bit as good as what City were in the second half. It was a brilliant match.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. And the other good result as well, I suppose, was the United result from their point of view during the week. 6-2 kind of blew Roma away, didn't they?
It was a great result, Reggie, but I thought the standard was absolutely desperate, yeah. I have to say, for a Europa League semi-final. And you look at the other semi-final with Villarreal and Arsenal as well, two average teams. I just think the standard at Europa League has dropped massively. And I know United, all the arguments is, are they closing on City? And people will tell me they are. I don't think they are, Reggie. I know the table will point to that, the fact that they're second, and I think it's 11 points. And if they finish second, people will argue. And in fairness to Solskjaer, that's all he can do. People will argue and say it's progress. Well, to me, they're still a good bit behind what we watched on Wednesday night. And it is a lesser competition, but I just felt Roma were a disgrace. The 6-6 goals in a semi-final, and some of the goals they gave away as well, I have to say I thought it was shocking, the standard, Reggie.
Yeah, no doubt about it. It wasn't good. It wasn't good. The Premier League, of course, still going well, but the big one this weekend is the United-Liverpool clash. There's a good piece there. A trip back down memory lane for me in the Irish Indo by Aidan Fitzmaurice today. He's going back over the 1985 Liverpool-United game, where it was a one-all draw. McGrath got the goal and Craig Johnson got the Liverpool goal. But it just gives you an idea of the rivalry that exists between these two clubs and the kind of history behind it. And albeit that Liverpool are not going great at the moment, it should all be there again tomorrow.
Yeah, it's still the biggest rivalry for me, Reggie, United and Liverpool, and that's the way it always was for me growing up as a kid. And as you see, you go back to that days in the 80s, and it's been there for years and years, and I don't think that's going to change anytime soon, and I hope it doesn't change anytime soon. But it's just not the same maybe without the fans and the atmosphere, but certainly the rivalry on the pitch will be there. But I just think you're looking at Liverpool at the moment and the season that they've had. I think Klopp just wants to get the season over and done with, Reggie, and get the players. There's been so much going on off the pitch, and the injuries and probably the headaches he's had all year. And I know that's part and parcel of the job, and he's getting well paid to do it and all that kind of stuff. But I just think he's probably looking at it at the moment, get the season finished, get all the players back from injury, and maybe go again next year and see what they can do. Because I still think with their full complement of players, they're every bit as good as Man City. But we just haven't seen that because of all the injuries this year.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think they're desperate for a kind of a big result, though. I know.
Yeah, and there's still like the incentive is there still to finish fourth, and while that is there, Klopp will still obviously they'll be playing, and there's professional pride and all that kind of stuff. I don't think for a second that they're going to switch off with five games to go. But I just think in the grand scheme of things and the bigger picture, I just think if he's to look back on the whole season and probably the frustration that it's brought in terms of the injuries and the off the field stuff, I'd say he's just wishing the season to end now and get it over and done with and get all the players back fit.
Yeah, and I see as well there's talk of a protest being organised by both sets of fans, up to 10,000 of them trying to block the buses going into this game as a retaliation to the Super League fiasco. So
yeah, they're probably lucky in one sense the fans are not allowed into the ground after that, Reggie, what went on, because it was a disgrace, the Super League carry on there a couple of weeks ago. So they're probably lucky that the fans can't get into the ground and that they can only protest outside the ground at the moment. But I have no issue with that whatsoever, because as I said, those clubs tried to do, it left a sour taste in my mouth, certainly. I will never look at them as fondly as what I used to look at those clubs, never again.
In terms of how, you know, the Klopp and the season and how it's gone, and maybe his own personal feelings about that particular issue, is there any danger he could be going or leaving?
Yeah, there's probably always is that question mark, Reggie, and he seems to be a man of principle, and obviously he spoke out against the Super League, and then when that happened, I remember going back to that interview on Monday Night Football when his first reaction, and that night he had to be interviewed against Leeds and Liverpool, and I just knew by looking at him, he probably had to be a little bit of PC, but I knew just he was burning inside at the position he was left in, because they totally threw him under the bus, him and the players, and he was absolutely disgusted. So there probably is always that maybe feeling in the back of his head, and I'm sure he feels let down by what went on, and he's such stature in the game, it's not as if he's reliant on the job at Liverpool. I'm sure if he left Liverpool in the morning, he'd be snapped up by some other top club. So there probably is always that question mark now that's hanging over his head, because he seems to be such a normal fella, like us all. And from what went on, Reggie, I thought it was absolutely, I honestly can't get over still, I know we're 2 weeks on from it now, but the clubs, the lasting damage that has left for those clubs and the bridges that they will need to build, if they'll ever build them, I'm not sure if it's repairable, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I don't think you're wrong. I said that myself a couple of weeks ago as well. I just feel that it's done very, very deep damage, but only time will tell, as they say. Okay, Alan, as always, great chatting to you. Are you on with the podcast this week?
We had Jim Beglin, actually. Finally, we got Jim on.
Oh, great.
We actually have a big one this week as well. Jim was brilliant, actually. But we're carrying on the run. We're on a good run at the moment, Reggie. But both fans will be delighted to hear we have Kevin Hunt on Tuesday, a blast from the past, and he was some player, Kevin Hunt.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, good luck with that one. I look forward to hearing Kevin Hunt. Okay, Alan, talk to you again next week.
Thanks, Reggie. See you. Bye-bye.
And that's all we've got time for this week on Dublin's Talking Sport here in Sunshine 106. With thanks to InsureMyVan.ie. Thanks to our producers, Jonathan Randall and Jane McNamara, and all of our guests who joined us here today. We'll be back again next week. Take care, stay safe, and have a great week.